Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for our program is Harriet Williamson, and the man at the controls this morning is Jason Croft. In this hour of Focus, we will be spending some time talking about decision making, how it is we think about what is important and decide what we will do, how it is that we do that, how it is experts do that, how the experts think about regular folks like us and how we do it, and perhaps what we can learn by looking at different fields. So, say, for example, science or law or economics, and look at how people who do that kind of work think. And certainly they all have very distinct ways of thinking, scientific reasoning, logic, game theory. And each of those has a particular kind of power. We'll be talking this morning in this hour with Denise Cummins. She is adjunct professor of psychology and philosophy at the U of I. And she says that maybe it'd be a good idea for all of us to at least have some kind of understanding of how it is that different disciplines approach this idea of decision-making, and perhaps in a general way to talk about decision-making and how it is that people try to figure out what's important and what they'll do for themselves and for their families. All of this, these ideas, and there's a lot here, you will find in a book that she's authored. The title of her book is Good Thinking, Seven Powerful Ideas That Influence the Way We Think, and it is published by the Cambridge University Press, and does, in fact, try to sample thinking in different kinds of areas, things like rational choice and game theory and moral judgment and scientific reasoning and logic, as well as problem solving and reasoning by analogy. So as we talk, questions are welcome. People who are listening can call in. We'd be happy to have your input. As long as people can try to be brief, we just ask that so we can keep moving along. But, of course, anybody can get into the conversation. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. That's for anybody who might have to make a long-distance call. And you can also send us an email, if you like, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. I appreciate your inviting me.
So it's not, I guess, it should be not surprising that a person who is a psychologist, who works in both psychology and philosophy, would be interested in how people think and decision making.
Right.
But I guess specifically part of your interest in trying to pull all this together was the feeling that people in these different disciplines, so maybe we're talking about people who are in law, people who are scientists, people who are economists, you know, what have you, they all know they've got their particular way of approaching problems, but that they really don't know how other people do it.
Right. Yeah, and that's the major thing. There are sort of two goals for the book. The first was to let people know about the methods that experts use to make decisions in these various fields. And these are decisions that directly impact our lives, because there are things like whether we're guilty or innocent, whether a drug effectively treats a particular illness, where we should invest our money, whether a proposed solution is the best solution to a problem. Okay, so it's sort of, I like to think of it as, okay, this is the way the big boys and girls do it. Okay, then so there's not much crosstalk oftentimes between these various disciplines. There's starting to be more, in particular in economics. Okay. For example, the Nobel Prize winner in economics is actually psychologist Daniel Kahneman, because of the insights that he provided concerning economic theory and behavioral choice. Okay, so there's some crosstalk, but more seriously, what I noticed over the many years of teaching is that although we try to give students a broad sort of liberal arts education, we get insulated very quickly. And so we come out with a degree in economics or psychology or one of the, say, the life sciences or philosophy, and we think we're trained to think in those ways, and we don't know anything about how these other disciplines go about thinking these things. Thinking about the problems. So you'll find, for example, that science majors know all about hypothesis testing, but they don't know the first thing about moral theory, right? And then they're up against, for example, medical ethics, right?
Yeah.
And now what do they do? Mm-hmm. The philosophy and pre-law majors know all about argumentation, but they don't know the first thing about scientific investigation, and they are sometimes prosecuting or defending lawsuits that involve analyzing scientific data. It's brought as evidence, right? Outside of the business school, there's a precious few students who know anything about decision theories that drive the equity market and underlie our economic policies that impact their lives right down to whether or not they're going to get student loans. Okay. And outside of psychology majors, virtually none of these other majors know about how the brain is wired. Okay. The aspects of human nature that are underneath all of these things, because they're human beings doing this kind of decision making. So then we have these bright, well-educated people. You graduate, you get your bachelor's degree, you go out into the world, and then you're asked to evaluate proposed economic or legal or medical policies, and sometimes even to vote on them. But there's holes in your knowledge base, because you know what you were trained in, but you don't know these other areas. And now, how do you make an informed choice? How do you know if you're doing the right thing, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know what, at this point, what I need to do is I need to write a book based on, my lectures in these areas. I've been a researcher in human reasoning and problem solving for many years the various areas that are covered in this book, so that people can sit down and read and say, okay, look, this is how these are the jewels in the crown, okay, of Western thought. This is how we make decisions. This is how we judge whether somebody is a decision is a good decision or a bad decision, whether somebody's innocent or guilty, whether something's a good solution or a bad solution. This is how the experts have told us we should do it. And I tried to boil that down in a way. You could take the courses or you could get a textbook, and you know, if you're having trouble sleeping, right, it'll really help you read these things, because, they'll put you right to sleep, right? That's not my goal. My goal was to take these things and present them in a way so that you get the essence of it, okay? What is it they're trying to do? Okay, what is the motive? How are they thinking about these things? What are the tools they're bringing to bear? And then how are we doing it? Right. So when they do the studies, how do people measure up here? Because we're being judged. Right. You know, I don't know. On the basis of what are you being judged? And then I put in a little bit of neuroscience in there as well, just mostly because it gives you a better feel. OK, for how when you do these things, we're not computers. They happen in our brains, and our brains are wired in particular ways. Right. And they're affected by our nurture and nature and the environment and all the rest of that. So you have to understand a little bit about the way the brain works, because sometimes that helps us to understand why we are good at some things, bad at other things.
Yeah. Well, it certainly there are at least two fields I can think of, psychology and economics, and maybe there are others.
Yes.
Spend time thinking about decision making, how it is that people decide to do things. And of course, in economics, it's making how do people decide what to do with their money and
right.
economic decisions. And in psychology, there is a wide range of things. How do people decide, you know, what they're going to do and in a wide range of things. And I'm sure that then people in those fields will say, we do believe that that people have a set of internal rules. They may not know that.
Mm-hmm.
They may not be conscious of how they're deliberating, but that they do. At the same time, though, I think, and maybe it's, you know, in the nature of popular media, that we like to highlight cases where we think that people have been highly irrational.
Mm-hmm.
How do we get those two things together? You know, the idea that indeed people have understandable, predictable paths that they follow to make the decision,
mm-hmm.
and yet we spend an awful lot of time scratching our heads and saying, well, why, you know, person X, why did they do that? Or even groups of people, why did they do that? It just doesn't seem to make any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Excuse me. I agree with you. That was another goal of the book. Okay. It's fashionable to sort of beat up on human cognition. Mm. Say, boy, are we stupid. It's a good thing we've got these computers around here. Okay. Except, you know, computers can't do a lot of things that humans currently can do. Okay. They're good at certain kinds of calculations and so on, but really, at some point you need to have human intervention to make the final decision. Okay. Well, let me give you an example. This is why I said, you know, if you're going to if you want to ask yourself, okay, am I making the right decision? Well, first off, how is it that they think you should make the decision? So let me give you just a very simple example. You mentioned economics and psychology, and there's behavioral economics now, okay, and experimental economics, where they said we have to start paying attention to the way people actually do this. Okay, so simple example. Here's the dictator task. Okay, you're sitting there, I'm sitting here. You bring in some money, okay, put it on the table, and now the experimenter says, okay, David, you're the dictator. You decide how to divide this money. You can keep it all. You can give Denise some money if you want, okay? Entirely up to you, right? It goes away, and now what happens, right? What do you think people do?
Well, I'm sure the natural thing that you would suspect that people would do would say, well, I'm keeping it all for myself, because doesn't economics tell us what the thing we're always interested in is maximizing our benefit and reducing our costs.
That's
so
right.
We're always going through life saying, how can I get as much of what I want and pay as little as possible?
Right.
So in a situation like that, you'd think, well, why should I give you anything?
Any money at all. That's right. That if you now you've been well trained in economic theory, because that you have just summarized quite succinctly the rational agent, which is the cornerstone of economic theory. And a rational agent is always self-interested. You always choose the choice, you have options, the choice that is most likely to occur and is likely to give you what you want, okay, the biggest benefit. So you're always doing cost-benefit analysis, minimizing your costs, maximizing your benefit. So an economist would say, okay, that you should keep all the money for yourself. That's
right.
Not what people do.
Yeah.
Okay, what people do, on average, they give away about $30, about 30%. Now, for most people, okay, we will say, why was the person so stingy, right? Because hey, you should do a 50-50 split.
Yeah, that'd
right?
be fair.
Okay, yeah, that's fair, okay?
Yeah.
To an economist, the question is, why were you so generous? Okay, who's right? Mm-hmm. Right? So here's a conundrum. Now, you see where this is going with respect to, you know, what's happened in our economy, right? Okay, what's happened in economics is that in order to accommodate what people are doing, in order to predict what people are doing, they have to start incorporating norms of fairness and norms of reciprocity so that people walk in already with a bias, with a norm of fairness, where fairness really means a 50-50 split. And if the departures get too far from that, okay, you can have problems. Now, let me give you another example of an ultimatum game. So we do the same thing, okay? You divide it. Okay, this is a little bit like, you know, the mother with the, you know, the cake, and the kid divides it, and then the other one chooses. Okay, it's pretty much like that. Mm. We have the money there. Now you are the proposer. You're not the dictator. So you propose how to split the money. And I now get a chance to say yes or no. If I say yes, we both go home with whatever the split was. If I say no, the money stays on the table.
And nobody gets anything.
Yeah. Okay, it's called the ultimatum game. Okay. Now, under those circumstances, people get a little more generous. Okay, we're not around $30, we're more around $40, $50. Why? Because I have to reason strategically. I have to think in terms of what I think is fair, what you think is fair, okay, and how you're likely to respond to unfairness. Now, if you look in the economics literature and you look at game theory, if you look at prisoner's dilemma, you look at ultimatum, you look at dictator and so on, what you'll find is that when people depart from the, quote, norm of a rational agent, what they're doing is they're incorporating norms of fairness. They're incorporating norms of fairness, right, and reciprocity. They will, in multiple games, okay, so suppose we get to do this again. Right. Okay. Maybe in something like Prisoner's Dilemma or in repeated dictator or ultimatum games. If it comes down that you treated me unfairly, then I am going to retaliate against you far greater, right, than would be predicted by rational choice. In fact, you will pay a penalty to punish me, okay, for sticking you in the early rounds. And even if a third party is watching this and you were unfair, you violated that norms of fairness, that third party will pay a penalty out of their own winnings in order to punish you for not being fair to me. Okay? It's a very powerful effect, and it's universal. Okay, cultures differ a little bit in terms of how competitive and cooperative they are, and so on. But for the most part, you find within reason, you find the same results wherever you go. So this isn't just a question of what we learn from our culture. This seems to be a little something telling us something about human nature. Okay. Now, again, what do we do about this? If you think about the economic downturn, what happened in 2008. We have an equity market that's driven by people who are thinking in terms of economic theory, okay? And so what they are thinking of is maximizing their benefits, okay, and minimizing their costs. And they're not taking into consideration the impact that that has on others, okay? So we have a lot of anger and so on against these individuals, but in a sense, they're behaving rationally. Okay, so this is what I want people when they read the sections. I have a chapter on game theory, and I have a chapter on Bayesian decision making. What I want people to understand is these are the standards that are being held. What do you think about them? Right. What are the long run effects of these things? Now, I know recently, yesterday you had. You had an evolutionary biologist on, okay?
Yes.
And what's very interesting in that, in evolutionary biology, is the question that they had is, why is there so much cooperation? Even in the natural world, there's symbioses, right? There's all kinds of cooperation. Why is it there? Well, it turns out that cooperation can be an evolutionarily stable strategy if you exclude cheaters from future transactions. If you behave the way people are behaving in these laboratory studies, that is, you reward cooperators, people who are fair, by engaging in future transactions with them. But if somebody doesn't play by those rules, you exclude them, right? Now, the most powerful strategy is something that's called tit for tat, which means that you come in with a bias towards cooperation. If the person cheats you, okay, then you cheat them on the next round. If they cooperate with you, then you cooperate on the next round. And that will be in a tournament that was done in the early 80s by Robert Axelrod. This was found to be an extremely powerful strategy. It performed better than many of the very, very complicated strategies that were brought on board. Okay, to see in the end who ended up with the most money. Okay, in the end, it was the people who cooperated together and treated each other fairly. Okay, so those are the kind of things that I talk about in the book because I think people should. This is important. I think we have the academic stuff, but it's not a far leap to see how these things are being played out in a way that has affected the global economy.
There, let me just for anybody who has just tuned in, let me introduce again the guest talking this morning with Denise Cummins. She is adjunct professor of psychology and philosophy at the University of Illinois. We're talking about some of the ideas that you will find. In her book, Good Thinking, Seven Powerful Ideas That Influence the Way We Think. And it's the Cambridge University Press is the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. And we did indeed, what I thought was kind of interesting conversation yesterday with Dario Maestrapieri. He is he studies primate social behavior. He's at University of Chicago. Mm-hmm. He essentially, and people want to hear the interview. If they didn't, they can go to our website and they can hear it. And he essentially makes this argument that if you study primates, our closest animal relatives, and you study their social relationships, you can see very strong parallels between their social relationships and our social relationships. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting, and I was indeed thinking about this at some point when I started thinking about having this conversation with you, and that is that there are some people who would try to apply the rational agent economic theory to more broadly to human behavior. In all of our interactions, not just in our economic life, in all of our actions with other people, we're also doing the same thing. We're thinking about, what do I want? What do I want to get here out of this relationship? And how can I get it by at the least cost. So again, it's maximizing benefit at lowest cost. And I think, and that's an idea that I think a lot of people react very strongly against. They say, no, that's not, that people aren't like that. There's much more going on in human relationships. It's much more complicated than that. And I'm very, you know, curious about how you think about that idea and can, in fact, you broadly invoke that rational agent kind of way of thinking when you look at human motivations in all kinds of relations, including, romantic ones.
Mm-hmm. Sure. That's an excellent question. As it turns out, I've also written papers on dominance hierarchies, in primates and in humans. Mm-hmm. I've got a chapter in the Handbook of Evolutionary Psychology. This is an edited volume by David Buss, in which I talk exactly about that. And he's absolutely right. You do have dominance hierarchies are ubiquitous, in the natural world, and you also see them in human societies, Now, how do you define dominance, Most of us think dominance means the big one gets everything, it's brawn over brains. And that's a simplistic view, unfortunately, a very simplified view of what a dominance hierarchy is. The author, pointed out yesterday, the point of a dominance hierarchy is to reduce tension, in a group, right? Mm-hmm. If you have horses, for example, you bring a new one in, they have linear dominance hierarchies, everybody starts to be very upset until everybody figures out where everybody else is. Okay, but now, if you take a look at the evolutionary biology literature, the animal literature on this is what you'll find out, that dominance usually means priority of access to resources, which means that I get the biggest share and I get it first. Okay, so if there's something good, I get there first. Okay, it means that you cannot that your reproductive success, that is your ability to leave living offspring, your copies of your genes, correlates with your status. Okay, you see that, right? You cannot secure and maintain a high-ranking position on the basis of brawn alone. In fact, it doesn't correlate with size. What it correlates with is what I refer to as certain aspects of social intelligence. And some of the most important aspects of that is alliance formation. Now, what is alliance formation? It means, forming strong bonds with others based on reciprocating benefits, right? I help you, you help me. Now, the higher up I get, my help has more weight. Right, because I'm in a position to do more good. Right, I can, when I weigh in on a fight, or because I've got more. Okay, when I of whatever it is. Okay, I just have more to give, and I have more influence. So the higher you are on this dominance hierarchy, right, it's better for you. Right, but what's going to be how it's going to impact the rest of that group depends basically on how you as a leader behave. Now, somebody who I'd recommend writings that I would recommend on this particular matter is by Franz Deval, where he talked about chimpanzee politics and how what happened within his study groups depended a lot on the implicit strategies, that were employed by the people who were in positions of power, by the individuals who were in positions of power and authority, Some just basically said, all for me and mine, and, everybody else, forget it, Others just didn't like fighting, and so whenever there was a fight, they just thumped whoever started the fight, and so there was a lot more peacefulness. Now, so if you look at dominance hierarchies, what underscores them, what keeps them alive, even among other primates, chimpanzees and so on, depends on the things that I'm talking about right now. That is this social intelligence, and in particular, this reciprocity, help the cooperation aspect of it. So you have this complex interplay of competition and cooperation, and you can't have one without the other. There was a NOVA series where they talked about it may have been called Chimpanzee Politics, where they show exactly this. It's a very nice sort of microcosm of what you're talking about. There's a young, large male, and he tries to take over the group. Unfortunately, he doesn't have any friends. He hasn't built any any relationships, okay? And he gets soundly defeated by the older male, who has all of his allies. Also, you cannot do this, even among common chimpanzees where males are dominant, you can't do this without the support of the females, okay? He switches strategies. And he does things like kiss babies, okay? He goes around, you see him picking the babies up and cuddling them and grooming them. He goes around grooming and sharing food. Sharing food is very important, right? And that's how he gets to take over, because he has basically the support of all of these other individuals because he has engaged in cooperation with them. So, yeah, it's looking at chimpanzees, both common and bonobos, as well as other primates, is pretty interesting. You see a lot of human politics in there,
yeah. And
you see how it impacts the welfare, not just of the individuals, right? Because the selfish, selfish agent, the rational agent thing, is good for that person. They get everything. It's not necessarily good for the rest of the group, right? It's not necessarily that group is the one that survives relative to others.
Yeah. That's where, there was one other thing that I realized we're getting into a different area, but there was one other thing that we actually didn't talk about that now comes to mind, because he does also in the book, Maestro Pieri, in his book, talks about the fact that if you look at people who are climbing the social or ladder or at the ladder at work, he says there are basically three kinds of strategies that can be successful. And I think we've probably known all of these kinds of people.
Mm-hmm.
And he calls them the good citizen, the young Turk, and the Machiavellian.
Yes.
And essentially argues that there are some people who are successful because they're nice. Mm-hmm. There are some people who are successful because they're aggressive. Mm-hmm. And there are some people who are successful because they're sneaky.
Right.
And I suppose that's true, and that you probably can also see that same thing if you look at social animals, particularly primates. I'm
yes.
sure you see the same thing.
Yes, you do. Exactly. It's called, there's another book called Machiavellian Intelligence that talks exactly about this, the use of deception in other primate species and how crucial it is. That's another aspect of the social intelligence that underlies the social success.
Yeah. We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Denise Cummins. She is adjunct professor of psychology and philosophy at the U of I, and we're talking some about what you'll find in her book, Good Thinking, 7 Powerful Ideas That Influence the Way We Think. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, Audra McDonald. She's up for her 5th Tony Award for her performance in Porgy and Bess. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to experience delicious specials, fair trade coffee, and your favorite treats at the Intermezzo Cafe. More information about upcoming events is at krannertcenter.com.
This is Focus. It's our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here from Monday through Friday with 10 different subjects. We do an hour on each, and I give you a chance to call and ask questions. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about the problem of student loan debt and where we are with that, where it came from, why it's a problem. Lauren Asher will be our guest. She's president of the Institute for College Access and Success. In the second hour, we'll be talking about the emotion of disgust. What it is, where it comes from, why that's important in human development. Our guest there will be Dr. Rachel Hertz. She is a professor of psychiatry and human behavior at Brown University, and we'll be talking about a book that she's written. The title is That's Disgusting, Unraveling the Mysteries of Repulsion. And then one more I'll tell you about Thursday morning at 10. We will be talking about cybersecurity there, and Jay Kaysen will be our guest. He is a professor of law at the U of I. He directs the program in intellectual property and technology law at the U of I College of Law. You can check the rest of the week next week and also listen to past programs by going to our website. That is WILL.illinois.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. In this hour of the show, the guest is Denise Cummins. She is the author of the book, Good Thinking, 7 Powerful Ideas That Influence the Way We Think. And the Cambridge University Press is the publisher on this book. And as we've explained, what she tries to do here is to pull together characteristic ways of thinking that you will find among, say, psychologists or economists or lawyers or, you know, people who are in different fields that have very sort of distinct way that they problem solve. And she says that it's a good thing probably for all of us to be aware of these ways of thinking. And that it can really help in making everyday decisions. And certainly it can help when you approach, say, a policy issue, because we are confronted with policy issues all the time, and you might be asked to vote based on something like that or make an important decision about your life or your community. So the question is, well, how do you think about that? How do you think about these things? Questions are certainly welcome. In fact, we have somebody here ready to go. We'll talk with in just a second. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller. We'll talk with somebody in Belgium over in Vermilion County here, line number four. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Inge. Mm-hmm. And your guest. And you're talking about interesting ways of thinking. And one of the things your guest just said makes me really bring something to focus, and that is, she said that in bonobos and some of the lower primates that we see human politics, but that's a very homocentric point of view, and we seem to have a very homocentric point of view about everything we do, and really, isn't it more like maybe we have bonobo-type politics? Our politics have developed from their sort of thoughts and things because of the way we have developed over the years?
That's a great question, and actually, I entirely agree with you. I think these are forms of politics that are ubiquitous in nature. You see them become more and more crystallized, more and more pronounced in as you get more and more gray matter. That is, you know, more and more in intelligence. Okay, particularly mammals. But yeah, I think these are primitive political strategies for doing one thing, which is surviving and gaining power. So I entirely agree with you. When you see these kinds of strategies going on, the question is: okay, are bonobos acting like us, or are we acting like bonobos at that point? Right.
Yes, ma'am.
We would like to think that these are the primitive ways. These are the things that are there. Part of a very long evolutionary heritage for us. But the whole point of the book is to say, well, look, these are ways that some of our best and brightest thinkers have said we should think otherwise, right? Other ways that we can think about these things. Now, I jumped all over, economists, okay, and maybe in an unfair way, and I do say some good things about economic theory in the book, but I did want to bring that out. But there are many other things in the book, for example, on moral philosophy that tells us to judge not just what is good for us in terms of cost and benefits, okay, but what is good and virtuous and true, what is fair. There's also sections on scientific reasoning that tell us how to tell what is true versus what is false, logic and argumentation. People are going to try to persuade you of an awful lot of things, and how do you analyze their arguments, right? How do you know when somebody is pulling the wool over your eyes versus when they're presenting actually a fairly cogent argument that you need to take seriously? So I agree with you there. And what the book is about, again, is not that we're constrained by our biology at all, or that we should look down on other species. We're very complex creatures, and we do have this biology, this biological heritage, but we have these gigantic frontal lobes. Right. All of this intelligence, this very enormous brain that is much larger than it ought to be, given the size we are as mammals. And what that allows us to do is to reflect and to come up with better ways, perhaps, and fairer ways to do things.
Thank you very much.
No, mm-hmm. Thank you. Let's talk about science a little bit.
Sure.
Because here, and this is something that you write about in the book, and I think that almost on a daily basis, probably many times a day, we're confronted with the results of scientific research, and it comes through us through popular media. And people are doing work that has really significant implications for us and the way we live our lives, and human health, and medicine, and the environment, and energy production, and on and on. And then the question is, well, how does one evaluate that? What do you do with that? And how do you take that kind of information and then think about what we as a society should be doing, or what we as individuals should be doing with our own health? And I think here that I think that the argument is often made is that in fact that people really don't understand very well what scientists do.
Yes.
And that if they did, that might help them better evaluate the results of all these studies we keep hearing about and decide, well, based on study X, do we want to then go out and do something or not do something?
All right. That's an excellent question. This is, again, another reason why I wrote the book. We live in a time where we really need to know about scientific methodology. Now, most of us, when we think about science, we think of test tubes and high-level equipment and so on, but it's really a way of approaching a question. It's a way of trying to find out the truth, right? In the legal system, we try to get out the truth. We get at the truth by investigating, asking questions, okay, piling up a lot of evidence and seeing who has more on their side. Science goes about it slightly differently, and it's a very powerful way of actually finding the truth. Now, one of the things that we have to appreciate is that a single experiment, okay, can falsify a particular hypothesis, but usually it doesn't dismantle an entire theory, okay? There are reasons why there are stopgaps in the scientific process so that we don't sort of, you know, sometimes when I read the popular press, we say, oh, well, this study found this. Oh, this study found that, found the opposite, okay? Mm-hmm. That's the way, when you're on the cutting edge of science, that's what it looks like, right? So what do? Well, you notice usually some kind of regularity, right? And we tend to think in terms of causal terms. We see a regularity. Two things tend to happen together, right? And if we can think of a plausible mechanism whereby one can bring the other about, we think that one causes the other. So you have a hypothesis now that A causes B. You have to test it, right? We have a bias called confirmation bias, right? It's what basically the legal system is based on, okay? You get two parties, two sides trying to build up more and more evidence to prove that they're right, right? There's a twist in science where what you try to do is prove yourself wrong. So you think that A causes B. The alternative hypothesis, okay, is that A is completely unrelated to B. Then what you try to do is conduct an experiment that can tell which one of those is true. So what you're doing is seems very counterintuitive, right? You're setting up the stage. You're doing an experiment, not to prove that you're right, but to find out what the truth is by saying, I have two hypotheses and only one of them, okay, can be consistent with the data. And now which one of those turn out to be? Lots of things can be different between the way an experiment is done here and an experiment is done there, right? There's different variables that may not be controlled for. So sometimes you'll find out that, oh, vitamin E is good for you. Then you'll find out vitamin E is not good for you, right? Well, if you look at the studies, it turns out that they were looking at certain kind of patient populations or the dosage that was used, right? So we'll have all of this kind of a like a rugby scrum or something going on. And eventually the truth emerges. But at the cutting edge, that's what it looks like. Okay, so I talk a little bit about the scientific method and the importance of trying to falsify your hypotheses, trying to prove that you're wrong, which is something that we don't like to do, which is exactly why we need to do it, okay? And how scientists go about doing that. Now, because we're very sophisticated these days, we have sophisticated ways of doing it. For one thing, you always have to ask the question, compared to what? So, serotonin reuptake inhibitors, okay, improve depression. Compared to what? Compared to not taking them? Compared to taking something else? Compared to doing therapy? Compared to what? Compared to taking a sugar pill? Okay, you can't get in the door in scientific investigation unless you can ask that basic question. You've got a theory and you think you've brought something to the table, but compared to what?
Hmm.
So your control group has got to be solid. Otherwise, nobody's going to take you seriously. Okay, you're just not going to get off the ground. Secondly, because you are asking questions about groups of individuals and whether something is going to be replicable, you have to know a little bit about statistics, right? Because what you're saying is, what's the chance, okay, that this would happen? What's the chance that this difference that seems to be there is got nothing to do, okay, with what I hypothesized? Other factors were at play, okay, or just chance factors are at play. And that's where statistics will tell you. Is the probability 1 out of 100, 5 out of 100, 10 out of 100? And we're very conservative. We say there has to be fewer than 5 out of 100 chances. Otherwise, that this could have occurred just by chance. Otherwise, I'm not listening to you. Okay? So we have all of these hurdles that we need to go through. Then we go through a peer review process to get something published. You have to have experts who are peers, who are also experts in the area that you're, they have to read those things, and they are supposed to analyze, was this properly done? Were there factors that were not controlled? Okay. Are there alternatives that were not pursued? Okay. That could be at play. Then if you jump over all those hurdles, it'll get published. Once it gets published, I guarantee you, if it's a major result, you're going to get about 25, 50, 100, you know, other laboratories involved trying to either replicate it or find out what was wrong with that. In the long run, okay, and it may just be a matter of, you know, a couple of years, you'll find out what the truth is, right? Mm-hmm. But that is the endeavor. So I have a chapter on scientific reasoning, talks about, you know, what makes us think that one thing causes another and how we go about testing hypotheses. And those really are shining jewels of Western inquiry, okay? That is something that we can put on the table and say, these scientific methods are really what brought us where we are today, you know, across a variety of fields, in particular medicine. Yeah.
What I think that here, what's sort of difficult about this book, difficult and good, is that any one of these things we could sit here and talk for a whole
right.
hour.
So,
but I think what I think that maybe is difficult about this, or that people find difficult, is this idea that I guess if you say to people, okay, here's basically what we're talking about. We're talking about scientists. They're looking at the world. They're looking at what's out there, and they're trying to establish relationships between things. And they're saying, I think A causes B.
Mm-hmm.
Let's test that, and that's what an experiment is. You know, you try to set up a situation where you test. Well, does A cause B?
Mm-hmm.
And you try to make it as simple and straightforward as possible, so that you can truly establish yes, A causes B. The problem is with the world is that there's not just A and B. There's all kinds. There's an entire multiplicity of factors
exactly
that go
right.
together. So, mm-hmm. I guess that's the issue in making your experiment simple enough so that you actually can establish that causal relationship, you're going to have to reduce the number of variables involved. And the thing about the world is it's just not a simple place.
It's not a
like
simple
that.
Place, but oftentimes there's a lot of things going on, but most of them don't matter. There will be, you know, crucial things that are at play. Again, you know, using depression as an example, okay, there may be many, many, many factors that lead to depression, but we do know one thing, which is that if your serotonin levels are low, you're going to feel depressed, okay? You can then take some medication or do something, other things to try to raise those levels, right? Now, that doesn't answer all of the problems, but it is one factor. Our hypotheses oftentimes can be more complex than just A causes B. It can be A to C, okay, organized in this particular pattern is going to lead to the result, right? Those are more complicated to test, but that's why we do things like causal path modeling, okay, statistical method, to sort of tease out there are many factors at play here. Which ones are important and which ones are just background noise? And how do they interact with each other to produce the effect?
Well, then how? Okay, so if we have people who are not scientists,
mm-hmm.
And who are trying to evaluate the result of science,
mm-hmm.
what's the most important thing for people to look at? Or are there a couple things for them to look at if they're asking the question, this scientist did this study And this was her conclusion. And do I take that seriously? And do I change my life as a result?
First, I think the most important question, first off, is the one that I just said, compared to what? Mm-hmm. Okay. And if the news article doesn't tell you compared to what, doesn't tell you what the controls were, okay, then you need to go. And now if you get public funding, if you get funding from the National Institutes of Health or NSF, National Science Foundation, you have to make your abstract available for anybody to read. You can also get to the actual paper usually by just going to a library. Okay, so you are allowed basically to know what was done. When they write the abstracts, we are supposed to be writing abstracts in the way that an intelligent lay reader can read and understand. If they didn't do it, if you can't understand it, they didn't do their job right. They should be able to explain this in a way that answers those basic questions. What was the hypothesis? Okay, how did you test it? So that you can answer compared to what, right? Hmm. And you can read very simply their methodology and their conclusions. So, you know, how do you analyze things? When you read something in the newspaper, ask yourself compared to what? Ask yourself, are there alternative hypotheses that were considered and were they ruled out? Especially when it comes to human behavior, right? So, you know, this caused somebody to do that. What are the alternatives? What alternatives were considered? What alternatives would explain why this person killed somebody, or why this person is depressed, or why this person is a good parent, right? The researcher is going to have a particular hypothesis in mind that they were testing, okay, a pet theory. And the question is, what are the alternatives? If you ask yourself that question always with respect to everything, what are the alternatives compared to what? You will increase your decision-making efficiency. Because if you don't, you're going to get oftentimes hooked in to the first thing that comes to mind or to what somebody's telling you because they're very persuasive, right? You want to always consider the alternatives.
We just have about 4 minutes left.
Okay.
And unfortunately, we've saved what I think may be the most interesting thing really very much to the end. But we can talk about it for a little bit. And this has to do with sort of this matter is that as we go through the world, we will encounter things that we have never seen before, stuff that's completely new. And that's probably always been the case with human experience. You know, you come across something and you think, what is this? And so we have a way of trying to think about something that we have never seen before. And that's by sort of asking this question, well, is this kind of like something that I do know?
Yes, exactly. And we call that analogical reasoning. And it is incredibly powerful, almost too powerful. Okay, so when you reason by analogy, what you're saying is this is like that. And that's really important because there's so much stuff out there to learn. And so what we try to do when we try to learn something new is we try to understand it in terms of something we already understand because that simplifies things. The problem is that the metaphor analogy that we choose can sometimes be helpful, sometimes not. Let me give you a very simple example, okay? We all, when we took science, we learned about how the atom is like the solar system, right? And the electrons circle around, you know, the nucleus and the way that the planets circle around, orbit around the sun. And so you'd say, okay, so what do I understand about the solar system? Oh, so that means that the nucleus must be more massive, right? Because the sun is more massive. And you say, yes, exactly. That's a wonderful analogy. Is the nucleus hot? Why would you not? Why would you not, right? That's the problem with analogy, right? Because you're going to map all of those relations from the solar system onto the atom, and it's going to mislead you into thinking that the nucleus of an atom is hot because the sun is hot, right? Okay. You see what the problem is? Yeah. That's why analogy is very useful, but it can mislead us. Now, and again, I'm sorry to keep beating up on the economists, okay? But one of the examples...
Oh, that's okay. Go right ahead.
One of the examples that I use in the book is how Ben Bernanke persuaded us to approve the bailout of the financial industry. He did so by using the following analogy. He said, imagine that you have an irresponsible neighbor who smokes in bed and sets fire to his house. Should you call the fire department or should you simply walk away and let him face the consequences of its actions? What if your house or indeed the houses in the entire neighborhood have made of wood? Okay, he said, we all agree that under those circumstances, we should focus on putting out the fire first, and then we can turn to the issue of assigning blame or punishment or rewriting the fire code and putting all the fail-safes into place. And, of course, when we heard that, we said, oh, so bailing out the financial industry is like putting out the fire. Okay? It was an extremely powerful and persuasive analogical argument. Right. And it persuaded most of us to go with it. Now, if you read the responses that people had to this, when they argued against it, there were some people who brought the facts and figures and so on. But the ones who were most persuasive were saying things like, no, this is more like the castle on the hill. Okay. That's been raining down on us is on fire. Okay. And why should the people in the village, run up the hill with the buckets of water? Okay, so they counter-argued by coming up with even better analogies that argued the other way. When somebody brings an analogy, analogical reasoning, therefore, is a very powerful. It's sort of like a razor in the hands of a monkey type thing. Okay, it's very, very powerful. That's why you have to be very careful when you use it. It's excellent for helping us understand new things, but it can very easily mislead us. And when people use analogical arguments or metaphors to try to persuade us of something, use your compared to what. Okay, again, because you can probably come up with four or five metaphors that would lead to opposite conclusions. And at that point, you realize that, maybe this is not the way this problem should be analyzed at all.
I'm really sorry that we're going to have to stop. There's so many other interesting things we could talk about, including this, some arguments about, are we truly rational creatures or not? Mm-hmm. But people will have to go to the book if they were interested in that and some of these other issues about different ways of thinking and how we could all benefit by understanding them. The title of the book is Good Thinking, Seven Powerful Ideas That Influence the Way We Think. It is published by the Cambridge University Press. It's a paperback, so it is not particularly expensive. And if you're interested in reading it, and I would recommend, by our guest Denise Cummins. Yes?
And I just wanted to mention that there is a website for the book called goodthinkingbooks.com. And you can. It has other information about the book, and most particular, there are the answers to the insight problems. I didn't put the answers in the book, but the answers are on the website.
All right. Our guest Denise Cummins is adjunct professor of psychology and philosophy at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. Thanks very much.
Thank you. This was fun.